You're listening to Love and Revolution Radio, covering the heart of change and changes of the heart, featuring stories of ordinary, extraordinary people who are waging struggles for love and revolution.
This week on Love and Revolution Radio, we interview Tom Attlee of the Co-Intelligence Institute about his new book, Participatory Sustainability, and how we can all engage deliberative dialogues, participatory democracy, and our whole community in the question of how we're going to live sustainably on this beloved Earth.
It goes beyond respecting people, which is sort of the individual, let's not put each other down, into the holistic sense that every part is a part of the whole. So whatever is somebody is saying and feeling is a piece of what's real. Even if they're totally embedded in lies and propaganda, the fact that they feel that way is part of the whole, part of what's real. And in order to be wise, we need to take into account as much as we can of what's real.
Before you with her hands on her hips, she said, I'll accept love and loving words from your lips. She said, everything changes with conviction like this. I need you to be good right now. I need you to be good, good, and how. I need you to be love right now. I need you to be love, love, love.
This is Sherry Mitchell for Love and Revolution Radio. Kwe Iguanu, hello and welcome. I'm coming to you from chilly Benoibskik territory, where it's a bright, sunshiny day. We're getting ready for another snowpocalypse, another 2 feet of snow coming tomorrow. And as always, I am sitting in my little nest along the edges of the beautiful Penobscot River in central Maine, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Ms. Rivera Sun. Hello, Rivera.
Greetings, Sherry, here in New Mexico, where I am. It is bright and sunny and spring-like, but I'm a little bit down in the heart because I just found out that our town council is looking at an ordinance that is in the style of what's become known as a homeless hate law throughout the country. So we're going to have to go down and get engaged with our town and tell them it's not okay to pass a law that violates human rights, bans sleeping, and discriminates against a certain class of people. It's never dull in these times, and we do have to show up over and over again. Now, democracy is at the heart of what I'm dealing with here, or lack thereof, since certain people in our town get representation and other people don't. But we're going to talk about a variation of democracy and a different kind of application of why participatory democracy is so important. Our guest this week is Tom Attlee, who is a social theorist, a visionary, and a writer. He's the founder of the Co-Intelligence Institute, the author of The Tao of Democracy, and he has just released an intriguing little volume called Participatory Sustainability. Now, like you listeners, I'm pretty curious why participation and sustainability not just can go hand in hand, but must go hand in hand. And we'll be asking Tom a lot about that on today's show. Tom, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tom, thank you for joining us on the show today. I'm really interested in diving into this material. I would love to start out with you describing for our listeners this idea of co-intelligence. And what does it mean to you, and how does it come into play when we're talking about participatory sustainability and participatory democracy?
Well, I see the fundamental part of intelligence is two fundamental parts are solving problems and learning. People usually associate those with intelligence. And I became curious in the early 90s what intelligence would look like if it was tied really closely to wholeness and interconnectedness and co-creativity. Because right now we have very fragmented kinds of intelligence, separate people using their analytical powers to cut and carve the universe into pieces and figure out how to control those pieces, etc. That's a very powerful and dangerous kind of intelligence. It is intelligence. There's no question about it. You can solve problems and learn that way, but our planetary destiny is kind of tied to our ability to see a bigger picture, to see the whole, to sense the interconnectedness between things, and to use more of our capacities, to use our spirit, our compassion, you know, our other forms of intelligence than analytic, fact-based intelligence, which is a really important piece of the puzzle. But like having empathy cut off from rationality and rationality cut off from empathy, just to name a particularly powerful combination that is often seen as a problem rather than combining the two in various ways. So co-intelligence is trying to be a more holistic, embracive form of intelligence. Our collective capacities to see and engage and understand our environment, what does that look like? And our ability to move with the things that are going on, you know, when there's a situation that presents itself, to what extent are we trying to dominate the situation, you know, go from A to B, and to what extent are we working with the energies that that exist in that situation? Those are like collaborative intelligence and collective intelligence, and the different ways that we can embrace the whole, that we can access the wisdom of the whole on behalf of the well-being of the whole is sort of a general inquiry that I have. And the whole is the whole community, the whole world, the whole situation, whatever. It's a sort of holistic way of sensing into intelligence, and wisdom being a natural part and companion of that. I see wisdom as a application of intelligence to a larger picture. You know, the bigger the picture we can embrace with our intelligence, the more wise we are able to be. That's a general description of that. There's lots more on my cointelligence.org website, and there's a chapter in the book, Participatory Sustainability Book, about it. It sort of underlies my sense that wholeness is really what's going on in the world. Even all the fragmentation we see is, in essence, an aspect of evolving wholeness. Whenever there's something that looks unwhole, sick or broken or in need of fixing or transformation, it always evokes energies to become more whole again. So that's there's a sense, there's a big wholeness going on behind the scenes all the time, as well as the wholeness that we're trying to achieve by fixing up the fragmentation. So that's all a riff around the basic understanding of wholeness and our engagement with our world, which intelligence is supposed to be helping us.
Well, I think when you start to talk about things like the broken, the sick, the ailing, the struggling, I mean, I think these are things that we see a lot in our world right now, and we see it in our social systems, certainly our economic systems, our political systems, but also we see it very keenly, some of us, in our ecological systems. So I'm curious about this title of your new book, Participatory Sustainability. Now, why is the participation part so important for sustainability? And what is the alternative? Is there a non-participatory sustainability? And what does that look like? And why do we need to really consider this?
Well, first of all, it's based on a philosophical assumption that we are participating in everything, whether we know it or not, whether we want to or not. We are participants. The elections, for example, we just had an election here several months ago, and the sense of people who didn't vote participated in the election. The audience participates in the performance. The people who are ignorant of the impact of their cars on the atmosphere or their chocolate on populations in certain societies that create the chocolate, we are participants. So that's a fundamental starting point. So the question is, how conscious do we want to be? How much choice do we want to bring into our participation? And the idea that when you look at the kinds of unconscious participation we're doing in terms of sustainability, there's some people who are very conscious and go ahead and do destructive things anyway. The overwhelming majority of people really aren't aware of how much they are participating in the destruction of the support systems and, you know, living systems of the world. So to what extent do we want to make our participation more conscious? And that's one half of the puzzle, is that we are participating, and the question is how much and in what ways do we want to participate? And the other part of the question is sustainability has to do with these living systems, these human systems, the economy, the political system, educational system, all these human systems on one hand, and the environmental, ecological, biological living systems on the other. And the sustainability is the point where these come into interaction with each other, making this incredibly complex kinds of interaction, many, many layers of what's going on there. And when you look at how complex it is, and this whole science is, you know, chaos and complexity theories and ecology and whatever that study that complexity, when you look at that complexity, it becomes really clear that top-down linear approaches, which are inherently sort of mechanistic, they're trying to get from A to B, they're acting as if this situation is controllable and we can actually make X happen and keep it that way, but that's an illusion. That kind of control is an illusion. There needs to be a lot of self-organizing energy in every part of the system. All sorts of people have to be doing all kinds of things all over the place. Some one government program, one tweak in the system is not going to do it. So the question is, what kinds of participation can we design? What kinds of systems, what kinds of public policy enable people in every sector, in all levels of society, to engage in meaningful ways, in touch with each other as needed, in order to do this project we're calling sustainability? The unsustainability is standard for natural systems. You know, the vast majority of species have gone extinct. If we go extinct, we're just joining that club. But there hasn't been the kind of consciousness and choice present for those species. And we have this bizarre situation where we, some of us anyway, know we're in the process of creating our own extinction. We want to sustain ourselves in some kind of relationship with the environment. That's what sustainability is all about.
In your book, you talk about 6 expanded dimensions of intelligence and how we can use those expanded dimensions of intelligence to address the depth and complexity that you're talking about and the challenges that we're facing. Can you talk to us a little bit about what those 6 expanded dimensions of intelligence are?
Yeah, I mentioned some of them earlier, the sense of we need collective intelligence. We need to figure out how our individual applications of our intelligence can add up to something greater rather than, I mean, we use a lot of our very, very smart people are engaged in fighting each other, which adds up to nothing or bad stuff. So how do we engage together in ways that add and synergize so that it's a bigger kind of intelligence that arises out of us all engaging? That's a whole field of itself. And then there's collaborative intelligence, which is related but different, which is the working with energy, applying our intelligence in ways that are using the energies that exist in the system. I think of jazz ensembles when they're kind of in the groove with each other. There's a collaborative intelligence. They're applying their musical intelligence together in ways that add up to something. Permaculture. Permaculture is saying, here's a bunch of plants, here's a bunch of land, you know, a bunch of animals, sunlight, whatever. How do we work with what's there instead of like a major agricultural thing, just pouring a bunch of pesticides on it or something? We're going to work with what's there together with. That's a whole other kind. The idea of reason and head, heart, gut, all those kinds of things I call multimodal intelligence. There's a whole field which is popularized by a guy named Howard Gardner on multiple intelligences, looking at all the different ways we engage with the world and solve problems and learn. And we need to embrace all that. We need to not exclude the stories that people have. We need to include the stories that people have. We don't want to keep out the intuitive sensibilities that people have. There's really valuable stuff that comes from intuition. But do we always follow intuition? Well, no. We need to apply our rationality and our facts to help guide us. But these things can all lead and mix together. So that multimodal intelligence is another one. There's a kind of intelligence I came to late in my explorations of this. I call resonant intelligence, which is like empathy. And empathy is a big part of it. But in nonviolent action, I know that Rivera is majorly involved in nonviolence trainings. And there's an odd way in which the suffering of people who are putting themselves on the line, when viewed by a larger population, causes a resonance in that larger population. They watch that, and it draws them into the issue. And there is a sort of life-enhancing directionality to that. So as people observe that and their empathy comes out, they're moved to action. And that all adds up to a kind of life-serving intelligence. So that's what the resonant intelligence is all about. And universal intelligence is all the way bigger than human kinds of intelligence. And for some, that is cosmic consciousness. You know, it's like we will meditate and tune into something that will give us guidance from a different sort of different scale of beingness in the world. There's also the intelligence of nature. I mean, nature's been around for billions of years. It's been doing trial and error experiments for a long, long, long time. It has found all these solutions to things. There's a field called biomimicry that actually engineers and scientists go researching how nature has solved X problem and finding really revolutionary, you know, Velcro came out of that kind of research. So the sense that there are larger than human intelligences of various kinds that we can access and work with. And that's my universal intelligence category. Again, trying to access the whole. And then there's wisdom, which is the generic expansion of intelligence in many, many different ways to get beyond any particular perspective. Wherever we are, however we're looking at things, that is a box. How do we move out of that box? How do we look at things in a bigger way than we were before? So those are the six dimensions. I don't call them the six dimensions of co-intelligence. These are six dimensions of co-intelligence. I'm totally open to somebody else coming up with another one or five or whatever, as long as it shows how intelligence takes this whatever it is they come up with, shows how intelligence takes wholeness and interconnectedness and co-creativity seriously.
Well, I'll take whatever kind of intelligence I can get at this point. And I think the bulk of humanity, and particularly the higher into political power and social and economic power you get in the United States, could really benefit for increased intelligence in almost whatever form we can come up with. But, you know, we're in this crisis right now.
I want to question that because there is lots of intelligence going into creating the technologies that are destroying the world.
Well, that's what I was just about to say, actually, is that we have lots of particular kinds of intelligence, but a mm-hmm. real kind of concentrated and almost exclusionary use of one, maybe the rational, logical, analytical, break it down, and maybe not so much of the building back up even, kind of intelligence. And, you know, we're seeing that it's driving us down pathways that are leading towards untenable, unsustainable situations. So my question for you is, what might be some strategies for reintegrating some of the other kind of intelligences and in very tangible ways? I mean, I think in the non-political sphere, but on the ground in local communities, we might be seeing more of this. But what are some of the thoughts you have on how to get out of the mess that we're in?
Well, one of my own historic specialization has been in the political realm, particularly in the power of dialogue and deliberation among diverse people. There's lots of diversity in our political life, and that diversity is overwhelmingly channeled into battle. People trying to win over other people, trying to defeat the other side. And it's not even like multiple sides fighting. It's like it always reduces down to two, because the majoritarian system, the winner-take-all majoritarian system that we have, you have to have two players in order for somebody to win. If you have three, it's automatically way harder to get 51%. So there's a bias in the system towards having two sides, towards polarization, left and right, pro-choice, pro-life, whatever, all these things divided into for and against kinds of energies. And we who are involved in those know that that's not necessarily comfortable. I may support one candidate over another, but maybe my energy is because I don't like the other candidate, not because I really like this one, but I'm boxed in, you know, I'm forced into this space. But one of the things that's been found through lots of experience and some formal research is you can get very different people together, particularly when you don't have them identify themselves as, say, left or right. We're going to get liberals and conservatives together. It often works with that framing too. But just say, we want to have like this random split. So if we pick a dozen or two dozen people at random from a community, and most people freak when they hear this, but this, our jury system is based on this. It's not pure random selection. There's all sorts of stuff that goes on, but it's the idea of picking people at random, and then they identify as citizens, not as a particular category of political party or whatever. They're not partisan identified. They're identified as, I'm a citizen, and you give them a challenge. You say, here's a situation in our community, and we want you to explore it together and come up with recommendations that will really be helpful for the citizens and the people who are trying to deal with the situation. So here's a bunch of experts to talk to on various sides of this issue. Here's some briefing materials, and you know, here's somebody to help you listen to each other. And they work over it for several days and come out with something to recommend to the community. And there's hundreds of examples of that around the world. And almost always it comes up with something that's really meaningful and which the people who participated go, I've never been like in anything like this before. This is amazing. You know, the sense of empowered citizenship is gigantic. And it's very different from the partisan battles. It's very different from a forum where whoever wants to shows up. It's a very conscious creation of an environment where people can come together in more creative ways and come up with something. There's more creative and less creative ways of doing even that. But it's in that realm that I do lots of my studies. It's what are the optimum conditions for ordinary people to generate wisdom that is useful to the larger society in terms of public policy and broad perspectives. There's even a version that is how to give a State of the Union or State of the Community kind of statement by randomly selecting a bunch of people at the beginning of the year and having them talk about what are their concerns about the community and what do they want to see done about it. And it's like totally separate from the political battles that are going on. There's a bunch of citizens coming up with a statement that says, here's what we want to see, and this is what we think is going on in our community. And it's so different from the president's or the mayor's State of the Union address because it doesn't have politics in it. And the effort to identify what is the legitimate voice of an inclusive we the people, not the we the people that goes out on the streets on something, because that's we're claiming we the people, a piece of we the people as we the people. This is trying to get a legitimate voice of we the people and trying to set up conditions where that voice can be more or less wise, can actually, when they hear each other in their diversity, they start to shift in their thinking. They go, oh, wow, if Mary Jane thinks that, maybe I should think a little differently. And they start to talk about that. So there's that is one way to intervene at a political level. And a lot of my writing has to do with how to take that kind of form and inject it into the political system in various ways. We have here in Oregon, where I live, a system like that that reviews ballot initiatives, where a group of a couple of dozen randomly chosen voters get together for a week to look over a particular ballot initiative and interview people who are for it and against it and various experts that deal with whatever the issue is, and then come up with a statement. You know, what are the real facts of this matter? What are the legitimate arguments for it? What are the legitimate arguments against it? And here's what we thought. And that gets published in the voter pamphlet in amongst all the partisan paid for, you know, advertisements for this approach or that approach. But it's a a voice of we the people. We don't have a voice of we the people in our political discussions. So that's that kind of thing I love to work on. And that's a political intervention. There's also economic interventions. There's the idea of taking the environmental and social costs of a product, carbon tax as an example, and embedding it in the price of that product. So if a product is damaging in various ways, it then becomes more expensive than products that are benign or helpful. And if you could do that, theoretically, with every product that was, and service that were out there, if people trying to get a good deal would be healing the earth instead of destroying it. I mean, it's just a really fascinating thing to contemplate.
I think that one of the problems that we've run up against, and certainly in the work that I've done, where I'm an Indigenous rights attorney and an earth justice attorney, and also, you know, I work with people and I teach nonviolence as well and spiritual activism, is that this pay-to-play scenario, there are always those who are going to be willing to pay the price and absorb the costs of harm if they're still managing to be profitable. We have clear evidence of that within our environmental justice system, where the costs of the harm and the fines and the fees for not following the regulations, for sidestepping all of the protections, are actually built into the cost. And so that hasn't actually been effective, because corporations are pretty comfortable in absorbing that cost. Passing that cost on to consumers certainly might have some attractiveness attached to it, but then we're still commodifying our existence. And we're having everything measured in regard to an economic value mindset, this capitalist mindset. And I think that that mindset is actually counterintuitive to this idea of sustainability, and that that's a real problem that we need to overcome. So, you know, I get a little concerned when I start hearing you talk about building in costs of harm, as if there was ever an acceptable cost for the amount of harm that is being done to the environment. I just don't think that there is. And so I want to go back also to this idea of intelligence, where you talked about all of these ways of kind of like sidestepping some of the barriers that are out there to our being able to come together. And I think that those things are legitimate and they're effective, and they have a place in the equation. One of the things that I haven't heard discussed is heart intelligence. That when we have our intelligence separated from the wisdom of our heart, we act in destructive ways. And so what is the role of incorporating and including, reconnecting our heart-based intelligence to the intelligence that we're using to operate out in the world? How do we make a stand for that type of intelligence to be valued and to be incorporated into the work that's being done?
Well, I have two responses. The first one off the top is, yes, of course, heart intelligence. And there's different ways to define what heart intelligence is, and I'm interested in yours. But I would say whatever the kind of intelligence you are concerned with having involved in whatever reflections we're doing about our public life, I think that's important to do. Exactly how is always a question. But I'm curious, like, heart intelligence is often overlaps with people's intuitive intelligence, with people's sense of internal rightness or calling, or with people's emotions. So I'm curious how you would define heart intelligence, which you would like to see brought in.
Oh, we're going to completely sidetrack the entire show.
Oh, okay. Well, for me, it's significant.
I think it's significant, yeah. And I think it's a really good discussion to have if we're going to be talking about intelligence.
Tomorrow.
And we'll be back after a quick break for a station ID and your weekly dose of nonviolence.
We know the sweet world is not going to end, because it's always returning to beginning again. And tomorrow is one great mystery, my friend. So let it be good right now. Let it be good, good. And how? Let it be love right now.
This week's Nonviolence Minute tips its hat to St. Patrick's Day and the celebration of all things Irish. While many headed to the pubs with shamrocks pinned to their jackets, there's one contribution from Ireland that bears a toast or two, and that is the boycott. The word was coined in 1880 during the Irish Land Wars. The phrase refers to Captain Charles Boycott, a land agent for Lord Erne. It was a rough year, harvests had been poor, and the tenants had petitioned for a 25% rent reduction due to the hardship. It had been refused. Boycott attempted to evict the 11 tenant farmers, and the rest of the community began a social ostracism campaign, shunning the captain, refusing to help harvest his crops, and non-cooperating with his eviction efforts. Irish author George Moore reported, "Like a comet, the verb boycott appeared. Within 6 weeks, newspapers as far away as New York City were using the term." According to Wikipedia, the term now refers to an act of voluntary abstaining from using, buying, or dealing with a person, organization, or a country as an expression of protest, usually for social or political reasons. So for all of us who went out and celebrated leprechauns and shamrocks, be sure to lift a glass and raise a toast to one of Ireland's greatest contributions to a more just and equitable world, the boycott. Knowing this story and others like it is one reason why we say that you should know your nonviolent history. It has already changed your life. And now let's return to speaking with Tom Attlee.
From an Indigenous perspective, from my own cultural background, my own teachings, when we talk about that type of intelligence, that is it's the feminine side. It's really connected, like you said, to intuition. It's being connected to your understanding of your umbilical connection to life. It's really about being able to bring forward this sense of divine wisdom that helps you to recognize that connection to all life. What you talked about at the beginning, the whole, being the whole community, the entire system, the entire earth, all of the ecosystems wrapped up together. It's that kind of wisdom that connects you to your understanding of interrelatedness, interdependence. Mm-hmm. That type of wisdom that we've separated ourselves from by believing that the world can be separated into fragmented, saleable parts. Even our relationships, you know, I've said this on the show before, that we've even labeled our relationships with the terminology of capitalism. So when somebody's single, we say that they're on the market, that we have turned everything into this saleable framework. And it's separated us from this wisdom of interconnectivity, interrelatedness, interdependence that really is seated in our heart. It's like Mother Teresa said, that if we're not looking out for each other, it's because we've forgotten that we belong to one another. For me, growing up, I'm taught that whenever I speak, whenever I pray, whenever I ask for anything for myself, I'm always to end that with Ndilna Bamwak, which is a reminder that we're all related, you know, that this is for all of my relations, both human and non-human. And so it's all of that tied up together, that we have cast that into one of our fragmented silos. And we're not using it to guide all of the choices that we're making any longer, because we've allowed ourselves to be fragmented. And so that, when I'm talking about that, that's really where I'm coming from.
Yeah. Well, I am totally in agreement with bringing that consciousness and that intelligence into thinking about our collective situation and where we're headed and what we're going to do about it. And for people who have grown up in our alienated society, it's not so obvious how to access that. I remember a story of taking these kids out in nature who lived in the inner city, and their impulse was to break things, to pull things apart, and there wasn't a resonance there. It was so alienated. So I have a feeling part of the gifts that Indigenous cultures have to give to the larger culture is the fact of being embedded in place, the history of being embedded in place, the ability to develop a sense of right relationship to the life of a place, which then can be generalized out, but starts with specifics. And in a society that is protected from nature, doesn't engage with nature, and is always mobile and doesn't have place-based consciousness, there's a very different kind of consciousness there. And we can move in the direction of what you're talking about, I recommend systems thinking as really, really, really important, because systems thinking of different kinds deals with interrelationship. And interrelationship is one of the fundamental things we miss all the time in our decision making. But I think that Indigenous people, leaders, shamans, whatever, should be included in that kind of category. You're going to get somebody who's an ecologist that comes in, good. Get some Indigenous person to come and also speak to people, see what can be evoked. I don't know how to just arrive there. I know that we're going to be living with more and more consciousness, more and more consequences of not living in that consciousness. And more people are going to be moving towards that consciousness because they can see the consequences of not living there. But there's no way to just inject that consciousness into people or into the system. So from my perspective, there's lots of different entry points we need to do, bit here, bit there, all moving in this direction. And I am all for having wisdom councils that are all Indigenous people reporting out to the larger society saying, this is what we see. And they become seen as a part. Like environmentalists are seen as a special interest. And this is like, whoa, how do we get to a point where there's somebody who's seen as us, the big us, not just representing us, but in a funny way is us. That's what I'm looking for. And yes, all the different kinds of intelligence I talk about, there's little shadow versions of going on in occasional places. People are doing really well with them. But my effort was to say all of these kinds of intelligence and all of these modes of intelligence and this thing I call co-intelligence, this is a whole thing, and we need to try and do all of it. How do you bring the Indigenous people together in council with the alienated people and come up with something that is real to all of them? What does that look like? That's sort of where my effort is. And at each stage of the game, if it's done well, I have a trust, a belief that it would move increasingly towards life-serving and big mind consciousness. But it's not somewhere we just get to. It's somewhere we move towards. You know, it's a horizon we move towards forever. I don't know if we have time to do that, but that's why I'm putting my cards at the moment.
Well, Tom, I think it's interesting. I'm really right there with you with this vision of how when people come into a room together, to a table together, or into interaction, whether it's online or on the radio or wherever it is, that we change through that interaction. And sometimes not in great ways, honestly, and other times in very good ways. And I think in general, my experience has been that diversity or a diverse set of interactions kind of prepares us for living in what is and increasingly is a very diverse world. Now, this is a bit of a question from the far left field, or maybe the far right field, or maybe right and left doesn't matter in this question. But I'm curious, we're talking about sustainability in a human-centric way, in that people need to come together and make decisions about how we're going to live. But of course, the rest of that sentence is how we're going to live in relation to the rest of the natural world, which, as Sherry is pointing out, is very much a part of ourselves, or we are a part of it. I'm wondering if you've seen any models for successfully integrating consciousnesses or intelligences beyond just the human, whether we've had models from scientists or naturalists or very earth-centered farmers or lands people or Indigenous people that have offered us feedback mechanisms or database mechanisms for understanding what the interests, wants, and needs of a forest are, for example. Have you seen anything like that?
Well, I'm not sure about the nature of your question. I think, you know, ecology as a field is studying, it starts out from linear science and ends up in holistic relationship studies. And one of the most fascinating stories I read about ecology was there was some Southeast Asian community, agricultural community, that had a moral narrative about what you must and mustn't do and all sorts of forbidden activities, et cetera, regarding the plants and the plant spirits and when and all that. And these ecologists went in and studied that narrative, that meta-narrative that people lived on, that was their spiritual relationship to the world, the environment they lived in, and they could find ecological science rationalizations. You know, here's, if you do this to the plants at this time, the bad ghosts are going to get you. And that taboo actions were, in fact, highly important environmental rationales. Somewhere in the traditions, this had been embedded into the narrative. And the sense that the sensibilities and spiritual narratives of the people who lived there were a different way of approaching what the ecological scientists were approaching through their science things. So it's one kind of approach to it. There is a group called Pachamama Alliance, which was a collaboration initiated by the Achuar people in Ecuador, who felt were being intensely disrupted by the oil companies moving in on their territory. It's a very isolated tribal society. And they initiated a connection with some activists and said, we don't need you to help us. We need you to work with us to transform the story of the larger society, because it's going to destroy us all if we don't change that story. And they created workshops that have been done thousands of times to help people shift their story. Joanna Macy is famous for things like the Council of All Beings. People are trying to represent the voices, be in a conversation representing the voices of different animal and plant beings. So I know of a variety of approaches to that. How exactly they get woven into, in any formal way, the larger political decision making, I'm not sure. In terms of the cultural transformation, they are already having an impact, but the cultural transformation is going in many different ways at once, often in reaction to each other. I mean, there's lots of stuff happening in reaction to Trump, and a lot of the Trump support comes from reaction to the liberal, particularly the social liberal kind of activities have been going on, so you don't think of the neoliberal manipulations. So it's like there's all this stuff going on back and forth. Again, I focus on how to have all of that evolutionary interaction become more conscious. That's my hope. One of the things that I'm doing, the big project I'm in right now, is developing a set of design principles for a wise democracy. And one of those design principles is nature first. It's like the idea that in anything, any kind of council that is trying to deliberate and decide on something, the interest, the sense of the impact it's going to have on natural systems must be present in that council. And even in sort of local, where's the school going to be? I mean, it's like the idea of environmental impact statements is is an example of having that be present everywhere. And of course, people are manipulating and ignoring environmental impact statements. But that logic that this, our relationship to nature and the natural world must be central to everything. Now, that's just the design principle. How it manifests in any given circumstance, a whole other issue. But I agree that it is central, because if it's not, we ain't going to be around very long, So I'm totally in agreement with that, and I see examples of it, and there's been inadequate experimentation with how to embed that into the institutions and processes whereby we make our decisions environmentally. We have boycotts of companies that do the wrong thing, et cetera, and that's a piece of the larger puzzle. But in terms of actually consciously moving forward with that as a central concern in every collective decision we make, that's still a puzzle being worked on. And I don't know an obvious solution to that, but I know a lot of different pieces that are emerging that could be woven together and at least experimented with.
One of the questions that I have about this that comes up a lot in the work that I do, and it takes real engagement and a real willingness on the part of the people who are participating to be able to bring an openness to the work that's being done. And when we have individuals who have a very stringent and particularized mindset, specifically religious, I'm thinking about right now, mindset that really influences their sense of responsibility. One of the things that I write about in my book is about this childlike dependence that we have on some other solving our problems for us, whether it's the government or some other leaders, or even putting your faith in some God who's going to come in as a parental authority and solve the problems for you. And so when you get into a mindset where you're dealing with a group of people who really believes that they don't have to take responsibility for any of their actions, that they don't have to take responsibility for the condition of the world because they see some other life outside this promised land that they're walking toward, that allows them to eschew all that responsibility and put the weight of that off on their religious figurehead, whoever that may be. How do you engage this process with people who really don't believe that they have any responsibility for the conditions of their world?
First of all, from a viewpoint of randomly selecting people in a community, you very seldom end up with a majority of people or even a very sizable portion of people who are totally bound up in that kind of consciousness. There are some communities where that would happen, but the vast majority of communities, that's not. And if people are heard and treated with respect in those contexts, even they start to shift. At an interpersonal level, first of all, I don't think there's the solution where you get the other person to see your side in a conversation. That is not usually a productive approach, and it's showing up in the efforts to try and get Trump people to see our perspective. If you treat somebody with respect and make sure that they feel fully heard, that begins to shift things in their universe, not necessarily in a linear direction. There's a very compelling recent TED Talk by a woman who was part of the Westboro Baptist Church, who this is a major church that majorly attacks, you know, gays and, you know, pro-choice people and stuff like that in big, big, unreasonable ways. And she grew up in that environment. And then she left it. And she talks about why she left it. And the primary reason, the primary context in which she left it was the respectful conversation of people who opposed her and the sense that they were respecting her as a being and really engaging in real conversation, not an effort just to convince and dismiss her. And this is a non-linear thing. We can't just say this other person is wrong and how do we change them? That's a linear approach that isn't taking into account who they are, their life, their needs, their history, whatever. How do you engage people in ways that move them towards more life-affirming ways of seeing the world and where you yourself are willing to expand your perspective to embrace something that was totally alien to you before? At an individual level, that's to me what the challenge is. At the process level in a group, there's lots of ways, largely based on truly and deeply hearing people and having them feel heard. The phenomenon of what happens to a person psychologically and spiritually when they feel really heard is remarkable. It's a major consciousness shifting thing where they don't have to defend, they don't have to do anything with their ideas or other people's ideas. They just relax and they can hear other people more. So that kind of tool can be used in a group situation, which helps people be in a position to shift. You're not trying to make them shift. You're trying to have everybody in the group feel heard and be open. And then the energy in the group starts to have a life of its own and shift around. And it's not a bunch of separate people battling each other.
I wanted to bring that up because I see this trend going on right now that's been very concerning to me, where you have large groups of people, especially on social media. Not everybody has the opportunity to come together in these groups. And we have people who are making decisions on behalf of, you know, the larger population who are oftentimes funneled into singular-minded groupthink. But one of the things that's concerned me, because I agree with you that respect goes a long way toward helping to resolve differences. One of the things that I've seen lately, especially within some of the activist communities, is
this politics of anger. We have the label of hate politics, politics of hate. But there's also this emergence of this really angry communication style that seeks to shut other people up, that seeks to minimize their voices, that has thrown respect out the window. And it's kind of like the anti-intellectualism movement, where they don't understand the difference between respectability politics and simple respect. And I think that this is going to be problematic for us going forward. So I was hoping that we could get into, and we're probably going to run out of time because we always do, but I was hoping we could get into looking at how do we bring basic human respect, basic human decency back into our conversations when we can't just bring people, groups of people together to sit in a circle and have a conversation with one another? How do we do that on a broader scale under the umbrella of all the social media engagement that goes on?
Yeah, that's such a big thing. For the two things, one is the idea of having broadly visible conversations that are transformative for the participants. There's an example I push in most of my books of a thing that was done in Canada where they picked a dozen people consciously who represented the diversity of Canada. These people were picked for their differences. And then they turned them over for a weekend to Roger Fisher, who was a co-author of a book called Getting to Yes, which is a watershed book in the field, to see if they could come up with a shared vision for Canada. It was a totally wild scene what happened, and they ended up succeeding through intense conflict. And that was published, that was sponsored by and published in Maclean's magazine, which is like the Time magazine of Canada. And it was also on the major TV program the same week the Maclean's magazine came out. It was in 1991. And I hired somebody to find out what happened to that. And there were conversations all over Canada that it generated, this sense of having an archetypal conversation that shows what most people think of as impossible is possible. These really different people talking together and coming to a shared agreement. It's like, whoever heard of such a thing? So that kind of influence that is sort of, you're taking the bottom, you're putting it at the top, you're taking the ordinary people who are different, putting them in a publicly visible thing and broadcasting it to everybody and showing what's possible. That's the kind of thing I imagine could start shifting the larger conversation. But there's a more deep thing in my philosophical work, which is it goes beyond respecting people, which is sort of the individual, let's not put each other down, into the holistic sense that every part is a part of the whole. So whatever is somebody is saying and feeling is a piece of what's real. Even if they're totally embedded in lies and propaganda, the fact that they feel that way is part of the whole, part of what's real. And in order to be wise, we need to take into account as much as we can of what's real. So it's not just respecting them. It is evoking their piece of the puzzle in a way that it can really be seen and taken into account. And having an environment of conditions where that's happening from all sides. And that is the group collectively taking into account more of what needs to be taken into account. It's actually a resource. The differences and the conflicts are a resource for bigger picture transformation. And the question is, how do we get more of that into our political life? That's one of my dominant questions. And I have various little pieces of answers, but there's a larger answer still eluding me. But that question, how do we not just see somebody as worthy of respect, particularly so that they will listen to us or shift in our direction, but because they actually have a piece of the puzzle that we need to understand. And then how do we make everybody in whoever's in the conversation think that way and start using each other's perspectives as doorways into a larger picture that when we all see it, we're going to come up with solutions that we didn't have any idea of when we walked in the room. That's, to me, transformational breakthrough. And that's, to me, the gold standard of what we're trying to do.
Well, it's not just the gold standard, but perhaps the saving grace of our crises as we face them today, of the crisis in democracy, a crisis in economy, a crisis in ecology, a crisis in social systems. Tom, we are at the end of our show, and I want to remind the listeners that Tom is the founder of the COINTELLIGENCE Institute, the author of The Tao of Democracy, and he has a new book out called Participatory Sustainability, which is what intrigued us to get him on the show to talk about this issue of participatory democracy in relationship to how we're going to survive ourselves, adapt and change, and maybe continue the story of humans on Earth. But Tom, the question that I'd like to throw back at you, actually two questions. One, where can people find your book? And two, how could people take a first step towards building this kind of participatory sustainability in a small way right where they are?
Well, first of all, the book is available on Amazon and could order it through your bookstore also. Single steps. This isn't simple. For me, it is more a shift in perspective that I would hope. I guess you have a lot of activists in your audience. Activism that is focused on issues and personalities, you know, candidates or public officials or corporate whatever, is it feels like to somehow shift at least 10 or 20% of that energy into how do we change the systems that deal with all our issues and our candidates and everything else. And we keep putting things into this political government machine and outcomes, you know, it's like, so taking over our power and saying we need to put some attention on actually changing the systems that are handling whatever we're working on so that it handles it in a way that is more sane. That's a mental and strategic shift in consciousness. And that's what I would encourage people individually and collectively to reflect on. And until that happens, I see us continually fighting the battles that we're on their playing field, whoever the big they is, and they make battles for us to fight. And that never ends unless we shift the playing field. That's what Gandhi did. He shifted the playing field. So whatever the British did that used to help them keep power ended up backfiring on them. And we need to figure out how to shift the playing field so that the corporations and the power holders and the wealthy people are playing on our playing field and trying to find a legitimate, inclusive voice of we the people is one of my efforts to do that. But that's a shift from issue thinking to systemic thinking. And there's many ways to do that, but that's what I would invite and urge people to do. And I also have a book called Reflections on Evolutionary Activism from an activist perspective, which people could poke around in if they're interested in the title.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. This was a wonderful conversation and hopefully only the beginning of a conversation for our listeners. Hopefully people will continue to engage this.
I love that.
I need you to be love, 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 love and revolution.
Thanks this week to Sherry Mitchell for bringing in the heart wisdom and the beauty of the integrated approach to this conversation, and to our guest, Tom Attlee, for articulating so many different points about why participation and sustainability go hand in hand. Our theme song is Love and Revolution, with words and music by Diane Patterson and performed by Diane Patterson and Spirit Radio. You can find more of her music at www.dianepatterson.org.
And I'd like to thank my wonderful co-host, Rivera Sun, for the intelligence and wisdom that she brings to the show each week. If you enjoyed this show, you might also enjoy the things that I post on my Facebook page, Sacred Instructions, which can be found on the Love and Revolution webpage and on the podcast. You can reach us via the Love and Revolution page on Rivera Sun's website, www.riverasun.com, and we are Love and Revolution Radio on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes.
For Love and Revolution Radio, I'm Rivera Sun. Our guest Tom Attlee spoke about participatory sustainability and the role of each of those words in the other. Perhaps, listeners, you can look around your community and find a new friend, an odd bedfellow, or a total stranger to engage the subject of how we should be living in relation to the Earth and to one another by the time we talk to you next week.
What if you knew?